Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Hello, this is Mark Steiner. The agriculture bill is always that giant looming thing that seems to pervade the conversation every 5 years when it comes up for a vote and for a bill being introduced by the Senate to the United States Congress that has just been introduced in the last week. So it is up for debate. And in those intervening 5 years, there are people who always rail about the farm bill. A, it should go away and not exist at all. That it's just giving subsidies to giant corporations and should just give money to small farmers trying to build their way up and build a new system of agriculture in America. And those who say, no, listen, if we didn't have the system of agriculture, then we in America and the world would starve. So we're going to take a look at the Farm Bill, how it affects America, how it affects our economy, how it affects agriculture, our way of life, how it affects the Eastern Shore and the state of Maryland. We are joined by Ted Wyckoff, who is the owner of Green Branch Organic Farm outside of Salisbury, Maryland. Ted, always good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Valerie Connolly is with us. She's the Director of Government Relations for the Maryland Farm Bill. And Valerie, great to meet you and have you on the air with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Name I won't forget because it's my wife's name as well. And David Kirby's with us, who wrote the book Animal Factory, of course, joined us last on a panel on the Eastern Shore just a few months back. And David, welcome back. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be here.
So let me ask you each to start this way. And I'm going to start with David and then go to Valerie and then to Ted. Just for our listeners, describe to them, to us, what the Farm Bill is. I mean, what it says to you and why it's important, not important, and an overview of your thoughts on it. David, why don't you start?
Okay, that's a big question, but in my opinion, the Farm Bill is a hugely important part of our society and culture and politics. We've had it for many, many years. I think it's society's way of saying that agriculture is hugely important to us as a nation and that we need to support it in a public way using public funds, and that those funds should be directed for the greatest good, to promote agriculture, to promote good food and nutrition, to promote exports, to help the economy. And in recent years, things like conservation programs and nutrition programs for the poor, and most recently, in the last bill, there were some really wonderful things, such as Get to Know Your Farmer, which was part of the Obama administration's pledge to support rural agriculture. And that program ties consumers directly to producers on a much more localized scale. I just read that if this bill does not get passed, I think we revert back to before that, the 2008 bill. I may have that wrong, but I believe that that program is threatened if this bill doesn't get passed. On the other hand, it seems like everybody has some kind of problem with the Farm Bill.
I have to say it lightly.
It's a miracle it gets passed at all. And I'd be happy to talk to those later. I don't want to use up too much of the time here.
That's right.
But to me, the biggest concern I have with it is with the subsidies. And as most people are probably aware, a large portion of those subsidies go to wealthy, large producers who don't really need it at the expense of smaller and medium-sized producers. And again, President Obama has vowed and did vow as candidate Obama to reform the system to strengthen the criteria so that, you know, you kind of lower income caps so that people who make $1 million a year aren't eligible for subsidies. My my other big issue with farm subsidies is not only do they tend to go to the large producers and the wealthy producers and the corporate producers, the vast majority of those funds, millions and millions of dollars a year, or billions, excuse me, go largely to corn and soybean production. And that, in turn, is fed to livestock and poultry for meat and dairy. I think roughly 80% of the benefits of farm subsidies go to meat and dairy production, and a much, much smaller percent go to fruit and vegetables, if any. I mean, it's almost minuscule. And the irony of that is if you look at the USDA's food pyramid, the USDA, from one hand, is telling us, eat less meat, eat less dairy, eat more fruits and vegetables. And yet that pyramid is completely inverted when you look at subsidies, where 80% of the subsidies are going to benefit basically animal production, meat and dairy production, at the expense of fruit and vegetable production. So not only does it benefit large producers over small, and I think it puts smaller producers at a disadvantage, it benefits meat and dairy production over fruit and vegetable production. And just as a result, I was just at the supermarket a few minutes ago. You can get pork butt for 99 cents a pound, which is great, but broccoli costs $1.99 a pound. And to me, there's something wrong with that picture.
Broccoli and pork butts are different. Okay, let's...
Sounds like a good meal.
I guess it could be. Valerie Connolly, your take on the Farm Bill and its importance from your perspective.
Well, Mark, I do agree with David that this is a very important bill. The Farm Bill is our nation's way of acknowledging that in the 1930s, we agreed that 2% of the population would grow the food for the other 98% of our population. That the other 98% could go out and do, you know, great things. We put a man on the moon. We were the leading economy in the world because we've consolidated and we've said the people that are the best at growing the food will grow it, and the rest of us are going to do other things. But in that process, we have to make sure that those 2%, that the farmers who are out there growing the food for the rest of us can stay in business from one year to the next through drought, through bad economic times, whatever the issue may be. We can't afford to let those farmers go bankrupt in a bad year. And so the Farm Bill is about making sure there's adequate risk management to keep farmers on the land and to keep food in our country and the rest of the world that we're feeding. And we always talk about how the Farm Bill subsidizes farmers, but, you know, in actuality, it subsidizes everybody out there who buys food. It makes sure that citizens in the U.S. are only paying 10% of their income to buy their food. You know, the Farm Bill makes it possible. Farmers don't get to decide or place a price on what they're growing. And we sell based on what the market's paying for a commodity. And, you know, we've got the cheapest, most affordable, most reliable source of food of anywhere in the country, or in the world. And that's what the Farm Bill is about for our nation. For an individual farmer, again, it's risk management. And we think we're making great strides in Washington during discussions on the current Farm Bill because we're moving away from a history of subsidizing for specific crops and prices. And instead, we're moving towards a risk management system that will benefit all crops, all farmers, all commodities. You know, David mentioned his concern over the corn and soybean. I don't know if they were a priority in the old farm bills, but, you know, corn and soybean commodity crops got a lot of the benefit in some of the older versions of the Farm Bill. We believe that the one we're working on now in Washington through added crop insurance and then revenue insurance and more risk management is going to benefit everyone from the large producer down to the small producer, and we need all of them. We need everybody to be able to stay in business from one year to the next.
So, Ted Whitehall, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
Your perspective on the Farm Bill.
Sure. Well, the Farm Bill has numerous problems, and I think the main problem is that it exists in the first place. Essentially, when it began... I believe it was the 1930s, farmers were actually paid to destroy food while large parts of the population were starving. And that turned out to be politically not good. And so then they started to pay farmers not to grow things. And people were, you know, the farmers were paid to take land out of production and then they were paid for that. And that way it would tighten up the supplies and therefore drive the prices up. And, you know, it's not that way anymore, but it's still not a good idea. I think the best thing to do is to just have the producers and the consumers with no middleman. Let's not put the government in the middle of it, and let's just have people grow the food for the people and let them interact directly with the people that want to buy the food. And that is the most efficient way to have the fairest price of food. That guarantees all farmers equal opportunity to make a living. I don't blame farmers for taking the money. I mean, I don't receive subsidies, but I've certainly signed up for programs and gotten benefits from the federal government and certainly appreciate it. But at the same time, my tax dollars have been used to fund my competitors. It drives the prices of land up so that it makes it much more difficult for me to, because I don't get subsidies on an annual basis, I'm much less likely to be able to afford to buy land that maybe a subsidized farmer neighboring me would be able to buy. We are subsidizing all the wrong kinds of food. We're basically subsidizing a pandemic of obesity, heart disease, diabetes. I mean, all these things are linked directly to our agricultural system, which is formed by market forces, which those market forces, the subsidies in the Farm Bill, are a huge part of. New Zealand subsidized their agriculture was subsidized very heavily up until, I believe, it was about 10 years ago. And they went through all the same arguments that we're having in this country, where, you know, the farmers were very adamantly opposed to getting rid of these subsidies. They were saying people were going to starve to death and there was going to be unemployment everywhere. And they decided it would be the right thing to do to get rid of the subsidies. And now their agriculture has become, some estimates put it at 4 times more productive than it was when it was subsidized. So my argument is basically that, you know, I've been able to do it without the subsidies. The subsidies do not help me in any way when it comes to being able to expand my business, because all my competitors for the land, not necessarily other vegetable growers, but, you know, other land purchasers and leasers, they have an economic advantage over me because of the subsidies that they receive. And that I just think that the best way to do it is just to have the producers and the consumers directly interacting.
Now, I want you to clearly just to jump in, folks, when you have something to say, because I can't see anybody. But I can sense from your little voice that you want to say something to keep this conversation flowing, because I know that there are very different ideas here about how we should do this. And Valerie, when you hear what Ted's saying, and you represent farmers, and Ted's a farmer as well, there are very different notions about what farming should be. And if the subsidies were ended, let's say, for corn, soy, wheat, rice, cotton, which is where most of it goes, or if it was ended, or if the insurance subsidy was ended, so that you don't have the kind of cheap insurance in case you don't grow a crop or fails or the market doesn't meet demand. What do you think would happen?
Well, you know, Mark, I don't know what would happen. We've never lived without a farm bill, and the backing of the government to say we're going to make sure that farms stay in business from one year to the next for the most part. I mean, I think what happens when we have a disaster, you know, prior to the last farm bill, when we have a major weather disaster, the government has to come in and do major bailouts. I mean, we've seen that. Gigantic disaster bills passed in Congress at the last minute in order to make sure that farmers do stay in business and that they can pay their bills. You know, a farmer puts a whole lot of wherewithal into an operation. There's machinery investments. Most farms have to take out very large loans prior to the season in order to get their inputs so they can grow a crop. And, you know, it's months and months later before they see any kind of return on that, if they get a return. If there's, you know, again, if there's disaster or if there's anything that interferes with their income, it's not that they're not getting paid that year, but they've got a lot of loans they need to pay back, too. So I don't think that our country is prepared to be in a situation where we risk our food security. Again, 2% of the people are growing the food for 98%. And I think that the 98% like the assurance. They like knowing that their food is, that they're going to be able to go to the grocery store or be able to go down to Ted's farm and buy his locally produced products. But they like knowing that food is not something they have to worry about, that it's going to be readily available. And I think that's what this farm bill provides.
So if you look at, and David and Ted and Valerie, in that order, if you look at one of the things that created the farm bill in the first place over 70 years ago, part of it was the cost of food. Part of it was the Depression. Part of it was the cost of food. A chicken in every pot. Slogan came because politicians wanted to guarantee that people could have a chicken dinner when chicken dinners were only for the wealthy, or people who could really afford food. So, David Kirby, I'm going to start with you, and then Ted, I want you to jump in here because I'm trying to figure out if there is, and maybe there is not, a median ground here. I mean,
I think there is, and I think we're slowly, in fits and starts, heading towards that median ground. I don't see industrial agriculture going away tomorrow. I don't see subsidies going away tomorrow. They're here for at least, several decades as far as I can envision, and barring some catastrophe. So to me, the challenge is how do we even the playing field a little bit more for small and medium farmers? If we were to get rid of all subsidies overnight, what would happen is the price of grain would skyrocket and the price of meat and dairy would go through the roof. And, of course, American consumers would be miserable and complaining and throwing all the politicians out of office, which may or may not be a good thing. But then eventually I think these massive grain growers without their subsidies and as electrical and energy prices continue to rise and fertilizer continues to rise and everything that's needed for an industrial-based model, I think they would rip out their cornfields and go back to a pasture-based system where they rotate animals through different pastures and the animals fertilize the land, and then they grow very good crops on that amended soil without need for fertilizer and large energy expenses. But that's a transition that would take a long time, and in the meantime, people would be probably going hungry, which is why it's not going to happen.
We have to consider that by 2050, we expect the world population to increase by 2.3 billion people. Current estimates say that each farmer has to produce 70% more food than he is currently producing in order to be able to meet that population demand. So to go through a process where people would have to starve to get off subsidies with a growing population that we're expecting, I just don't think that it's possible.
Well, maybe we need more farmers and more farms. And more farms closer to cities. Valerie, you mentioned the 2% figure, but I at least in my book, in Animal Factory, and I thought it was Farm Bureau I was quoting, the figure is now down to 1% of the U.S. population is actually active in farming, which is phenomenal. I mean, anybody has to admit that. But what if we could get it back up to 2% or 3%, also through the use of targeted subsidies to get young families on the land of their own to get started with subsidies and loans and guarantees and things like that, we could increase production without increasing industrial production.
I think we differ on what the definition of industrial production is.
Animal production.
Farm Bureau is all about making sure young farmers have the opportunity to get on the land and new farmers have the opportunity to start growing products. We have so many programs that, where we're trying to bring young farmers back onto the farm and make it possible for families to pass the farm
on
to the next generation.
Why not have federal programs to back that up? I mean,
I think there are a lot of programs already under the current Farm Bill. There are many, many programs where USDA is providing funds to the State Department of Agriculture to help market fresh, locally grown products, to help market fruits and vegetables and things that haven't in the past been covered under a Farm Bill subsidy program. And I think there's a recognition of that in this country. I think Farm Bureau recognizes it, and I think that's why we are endorsing this move towards a different type of Farm Bill this time. And we know we've got to cut the Farm Bill. We're all taxpayers, and we all know the federal government's got a huge deficit problem, and we know we need to be part of that solution. And So we're saying with the smaller amount of money, we think the best way to go out there and to make sure that if farmers continue to produce food, that we continue to feed everybody, that everybody has the opportunity in the farm community to be part, whether it's a small farmer or a larger farmer.
Let me
look at risk management.
Is this Ted?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, so just to reply to a couple of points. First of all, the government in no way has any way of guaranteeing food. This food supply is directly in the hands of farmers, and the government is not the entity that guarantees food for the population. I want to really emphasize that. It is not the government that feeds the population. It is the farmers that feed the population. One of the reasons why food prices have gone up is because of subsidies. We have, in the last farm bill, ethanol has been subsidized, which has driven corn prices really high. The poultry industry is struggling because of that. The grain farmers are making a lot more money because of that. Now, their input costs have gone up as well, so it might be a wash in the end. But let me just read off a couple of anybody can go on the internet and look up. The USDA has public how much each farm in your county would make in subsidies per year. And I'll just read off a couple for Wicomico County. The top three farmers last year in 2010, the top subsidized farm was $42,840. Next is $36,425. The next is $29,676. And that's Wicomico County, which is one of the lowest on the Delmarva. In Talbot County, one farm last year brought in, over the last 15 years, one farm in Talbot County has brought in $1.75 million in subsidies in 15 years. Now, this is what I'm talking about when subsidized farmers have a huge economic advantage over non-subsidized farmers like myself. And land, they can afford to rent land, put irrigation on the land, buy land. And I unfortunately don't get those benefits, and I'm not asking for those benefits. I think the best way to guarantee food for the population is through we need a food sovereignty bill. We don't need subsidies. We need the ending of ridiculous farming regulations that don't allow people to, like myself, on grow poultry on pasture. I'm legally not allowed to grow more than 10,000 birds. So why is it that all these other poultry companies can grow millions of birds, and yet somebody just starting out, you know, just getting their feet wet in agriculture, is capped at 10,000 birds for their farm in the state of Maryland? And why is it that I have to get my well water tested every single year by the county health department when I'm legally allowed to drink it, serve it to other people? You know, it's already been tested once for drinkability. I can wash vegetables intended for raw consumption in my well water with no permitting needed. But in order to do chicken, I have to get my well water tested every single year, even though the chicken is going to be cooked. There are just thousands of ridiculous laws that prevent people from growing food for their communities and selling it locally. The advantages, because of things like the Farm Bill and like subsidies, all the economic and legal advantages have been skewed towards the largest industrial producers in the country. And that is why we have the food system that we have today, where all the milk needs to be pasteurized, all the meat has got to be inspected if you're a small producer. But these large plants, I mean, the atrocities that go on in these large processing facilities where the E. coli and the salmonella and all that stuff comes from, I mean, why is that happening? I mean, so what we need is a food sovereignty bill, which is, several towns in Maine have done this, they have declared it a citizen's God-given right to produce, process, sell, purchase, and consume local foods of their choosing. And I think that is the type of legislation that we need rather than subsidies. This country is, over indebted. The farmers don't need it. Corn is at an all-time high. We really need to get our fiscal situation in order. And I think that means cutting spending, especially skewing the marketplace in favor of the larger producers. There is so much entrepreneurial spirit in agriculture and small scale agriculture. And the subsidies are basically squashing that. Their people cannot find an entry point into the marketplace because of the farm bill and other ridiculous laws.
I want to reintroduce our guest. You just heard Ted Wykoll, who is the owner of Green Branch Organic Farm, which is outside of Salisbury, Maryland. David Kirby is author of Animal Factory, who joined us on the show a couple times before, along with Ted Wykoll, as a matter of fact, when we did the Food Inc. showing in Salisbury, Maryland, a few months back. Valerie Connolly joins us. She's director of government relations for the Maryland Farm Bureau. And we're going to take a very brief break and come right back with our guests. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are continuing our conversation here on Soundbites on Delmarva about the Farm Bill, the Ag Bill, which is in front of Congress now. Let's talk about where the bill is now. I mean, and David, I'd like you to start, and I want Valerie to respond. And Ted, feel free to jump in on this as well, obviously. But the notion of the bill being a bill for big industrial agriculture, you raised it first. What does that mean to you? And then I'm going to hear what Valerie says and Ted says.
Well, big agriculture is the one who has the money to spend on lobbyists in Washington to make sure that what gets into the bill pleases them. So one would expect the bill to be slanted in their favor. Small farmers like Ted don't have the luxury of, you know, parading up and down K Street trying to get stuff in the bill. I think that's part of the problem right there. I don't think that any politician would come right out and say this bill was designed to benefit large and industrial-scale agriculture. That is just what it does. I mean, I think we can all admit that. And I'm so happy to hear that Farm Bureau and others are starting to move in a more moderated direction so that we can reduce subsidies and make sure that what we do spend is more well spent, I guess. But I would just, again, go back to the consolidation of American agriculture and the vertical integration of American agriculture, where especially in the meat industry, in the dairy and poultry industry, these large companies basically control production from the very beginning right to the supermarket shelf, which is a great disadvantage for small independents trying to get in the market or trying to stay in the market. And one area where I personally would like to see subsidies go or federal spending go is to decentralize the animal processing system in our country. Large processing plants have become consolidated. They tend to be run by large animal production companies, and they can be many, many, many miles away from small producers. These factories run around the clock, and they require large amounts of animals to be delivered all at once. They require those animals to be uniform in size and weight because of their machinery. And all of that, again, benefits the large producer. It used to be, I interviewed pig farmers in Iowa who said they used to, when their pigs were ready, they would pick up the phone and call around to all of the different local slaughterhouses and see what they were paying for pigs that day. That's gone. And for a small animal producer to get his or her products into the marketplace is almost impossible. And so there's this real bottleneck where, you know, if you're not a large producer, you can't get your animals to market. And maybe Ted can speak to this. I don't know how fruit and vegetables do, but I do know in Brooklyn in the summertime, I'll walk by my supermarket and I'll see guys with jersey plates getting out of their station wagons with watermelon and corn. And it appears to me they're going right from the farm right to the supermarket. Well, you can't do that with eggs or beef or pork. It all has to go through processing. Well, and without access to processing, that makes it very difficult.
I want to follow up with the last part of what you just said, Ted. I mean, David, but I want Valerie to kind of respond to what the notion of big agriculture is first and if it exists at all from your perspective and how it fuels or doesn't fuel, no pun intended, this ag bill.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that we believe that there is such a thing as big agriculture, the way some people like to describe it as the boogeyman out there. Farm Bureau is a bunch of grassroots farmers who pay $65 a year to be members here in Maryland. And, you know, we happen to have, we are members of the American Farm Bureau Federation, and our lobbyist and our organization, I think, is rated somewhere around, you know, being the 15th most effective organization in Washington of all organizations. So to say that, you know, Big Ag has some sort of big money that they're paying big lobbyists for, you know, we're talking family farms paying $65 a piece to be part of this organization that is grassroots driven and pretty darn effective.
I'm sorry, I wasn't really, I don't mean to interrupt, but I wasn't referring to Farm Bureau per se as companies like Cargill and ADM.
Yeah, but a lot, you know, our Farm Bureau members who grow, you know, I heard you take a slap at vertical integration, and, you know, you're, I guess, entitled to your perspective, but from a Farm Bureau member perspective, you know, we've got hundreds of farmers on Maryland's Eastern Shore who were growing, or were either milking cows at one point or growing corn and soybean, and because of market fluctuation and because of weather disasters, from one year to the next, they didn't know whether they were going to make any money off their crop or not. And along came the poultry companies who were willing to say, if you, you know, we will contract with you and we will guarantee you a price for chicken. So we've had farmers put in one or two houses to begin with, and they found a steady source of income that gets them from one season to the next and one year to the next. And so it's part of our diversification process here in Maryland, you know, for farmers who are doing more than one thing. Chicken is part of what they do. And for them, they don't believe vertical integration is bad because they know they don't have the time to go out and meet with every grocer or find a wholesaler or a processor. They like being able to grow corn, grow soybeans, grow chickens. You know, that's their expertise, growing the product, not marketing and selling the product or processing it. And so for those farmers, the vertical integration system is great, and they love it. On the issue of, what was the next part of that question?
Go ahead.
That's good.
So let me just jump through it. And Ted, I mean, let's get into this thing for a moment. I mean, I wonder, we're looking at this bill, and I want to come back to something that was said earlier between Ted and Valerie over what's really in this bill and what farmers it takes care of and doesn't take care of, and we're going to come to that in just a few minutes. But it was said earlier, Ted, with the example you gave about New Zealand, but we talked about also, I think David brought up what would happen if all of a sudden we stopped subsidies and how the price would rise. I mean, how do you think that in the complexity of America today, that without any subsidy at all, any government intervention, whether it was on the part of small farmers like you or small farmers, let's say, who people will hear their voices in a couple of weeks here on the show who have left the vertical system and trying to do it on their own, that how they could even survive in a larger sense without some subsidies and keep the price of food to a point that Americans could afford it?
Well, first off, our food system appears to give us cheap food. We are paying for that, and we're paying for it dearly. First off, because our taxes are going to subsidize that, so we're paying it in our tax bills. We're also paying it in our health bills. You know, the obesity, the diabetes, you know, those types of pandemics that are occurring right now. I mean, we're paying for that, and then, you know, the environmental degradation, loss of topsoil, all those costs, which are very expensive, are being externalized and not quantified when people are, you know, when they say, oh, we have the cheapest food in the world. Well, it's not cheap at all. It's really expensive. And the reason why it's that way is because we have subsidies and other heinous regulations that don't allow people to farm the way they want to farm. They have to fit into this cookie cutter model where they are guaranteed some kind of income from the government in order to take any kind of risk at all.
I will agree with Ted that we have way too many regulations out there. And, you know, here in Maryland, I think we would look at some of the environmental regulations for why, you know, if you would go purely on a market-driven cost or, you know, without any support anywhere, and farmers would have to do all the environmental requirements that we're now putting on them on top of the cost of production. Well, I just don't know that there would be a consumer out there that could afford to buy food if everything was done without any kind of government support.
But we're talking, let me just throw this out as well. I mean, a couple of things I think that are around the food bill, or the ag bill, people want to call it different things, but the bill before Congress that comes up every 5 years that really funds or underwrites agriculture, underwrites food in America on some levels. that the subsidies to farmers for their insurance in this bill, if I have this correct, over the next 5 years is $93 billion. And some people say, well, it keeps farmers going, like on the Eastern Shore, Iowa, North Carolina, but that the reality is that most of that money goes to insurance companies and not the farmers to subsidize this and creates this safety net there for farmers not to fall through and keeps prices low. But that's a lot of money. And that the other piece that was written, the Agriculture Department said that farm profits this year on a cash basis will total $115 billion, which is 24% higher than last year. And raises kind of average farm income way above the average income of other Americans. So, that's part
and then,
of
it. And then add $40,000 of subsidies onto the income, you know, and that's 2010 subsidy rates for, you know, some of the farmers in Wicomico County.
I think those subsidy rates include conservation payments. That's a huge chunk of what most farmers get is payments to do conservation initiatives.
It actually says that they can't even disclose a lot of the different subsidies. So this is actually only a partial quantity.
There's no farmer out there staying in business because there's no farmer out there farming simply to get subsidies. These guys are using whatever payment they get, whether it's a crop insurance subsidy or whether it's under the current program a direct payment for something. They're using that to invest in the farm, reinvest in equipment, pay the bill at the end of the year.
We're down to the best
are out there farming. You don't have anybody who's in it just to get some sort of government payment. These people love what they do. They get up every day. They do a hard day's work. They produce the food and fiber for this nation and the world. I agree with that, and that sounds good. 80% of the world's population lives on $10 a day. Those folks cannot afford to pay more for the food that they are eating. And we see time and again, every time another nation improves slightly their economic situation, the first thing people do with that next $2 or $3 a day is invest in protein. They so want to be able to eat meat that, you know, that's where the money goes. There's a strong desire for protein product out there and for food that people can afford, and that's what this farm bill ensures.
Ted, let me let you jump in, then I have a question for David. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm not implying that farmers are, you know, just doing it for the subsidies. That would be way off the point I'm trying to make here. The point I'm trying to make is that for somebody that's a new beginning farmer, it would be more appealing to do a type of farming where they're guaranteed that subsidy every year because it's guaranteed money. And so this drives market forces. This puts people into production. The other thing about it is that because we do subsidize our agriculture in other countries, our subsidies in this country for our agriculture, and I'm not an agricultural economist, but I do know that, you know, we have stomped out the agricultural industry in other countries because we subsidize our food growing. And so we don't do other countries much of a favor at all when we get into the economics of subsidizing our production and then exporting it there so that we can sell it cheaper than what their indigenous farmers can grow it.
So
their indigenous people can't buy it, so we're producing it at a price.
Well, they could if they had some kind of an economy, and that's what I'm saying is we take their economy through our farm subsidies. They can't even – the basis of any economy is agriculture, and if we erode that for them, then they have no basis to build an economy on.
For the last 20 years, we have been participating in trade agreements throughout the world where we have had to – remove subsidy programs that tend to inhibit or that determine the price or in any way make our impact.
It's market manipulation, no matter which way you look at it. I mean, we just have to simplify.
David Kirby, go ahead.
Okay, Mark.
So go right ahead, David. Yeah.
I live in New York, and for many years I've been doing a lot of consulting work with the United Nations Development Program. And I do a lot of work on this issue, and we write human development reports for a lot of developing countries and economic reports, and farm subsidies is at the top of the list is what is harming these poorer countries. And time again, it comes up that Europe, North America, Australia are so heavily subsidizing their export that local farmers just can't even get into the business of growing food. So I think Ted's point is really well taken. Now, the reason these countries do subsidize, I mean, I think Europe subsidized much more heavily than we do, which puts their farmers at a huge advantage for exporting their products to other countries, including to this country, by the way. It's one reason we can afford to buy, you know, Brie, is because the French government has invested a lot of money in that cheese. But my point is that because we subsidize the way we do and because it supports this agriculture that I do believe is largely industrial-based, again, on the meat and dairy side, because it's produced industrially, because we rely heavily on things like antibiotics and other things such as heavy metals, countries now are starting to not want our exports. We just lost the South Korea beef market, at least temporarily, because of the mad cow found in California. Mexico has turned away U.S. beef at the border because it's too high in copper. We have no such standards in our country, so that beef was returned to the United States to be sold to American consumers. Russia and China, partly for political reasons, but also because of health concerns, because of the residues of heavy metals and pesticides and antibiotics in our food, it's very hard for American farmers to export. Hog growers in this country, if they want to sell to Japan, they have to take their hogs off all antibiotics 4 weeks ahead of time than what they do in the United States. Well, again, what do the Russians and the Japanese and the Mexicans know about our protein that we aren't being told? Why won't they accept it? And is it a fair question to ask, are we shooting ourselves in the foot by producing a product that major markets overseas aren't going to want?
I guarantee if we can't sell it overseas, we're going to produce it differently. But in many cases, those supposed concerns have more to do with blocking our trade and promoting their own product than any kind of health concern that actually exists.
But it does give them a legal out in terms of free trade agreements to say we're not going to take this specific product because it contains this specific contaminant, let's say. That's not breaking a free trade agreement. They can at least say, I agree with you, like, politics are at play here, but it gives them under international law, the ability to.
Would it be also fair to say, though, that, I mean, I don't want to stay on this part long, so I'm going to come back to something else at the heart of the Farm Bill that I think is important to discuss for all of us here and how it affects local farming. But, you know, articles I've been reading about the Ag Bill coming up, some people have made the argument that one of the reasons that we've had a flood of Mexican and Latino immigrants into the United States across the border is because the way our farm bill is written, we have destroyed the Mexican corn industry, which drives people off their farms, into their cities, and then into the United States of America. The same with Haiti's rice industry. Aren't those things real as well?
This is why I'm categorically against having a farm bill. It's farmed robbery.
That's an interesting. I've never heard that term before. Valerie, I'm sure that's not a term that you would use.
It certainly isn't a term I would use.
not even I would use that.
But Ted, I've never heard that, farmed robbery. That's an interesting notion. I think that we can come back to that particular subject, I think, another day.
Farmageddon.
And Farmageddon. You're full of them, aren't you? You have them all.
That's actually a really good movie that just came out.
Well,
I would really encourage people to watch it.
It's funny to say these things, but, you know, and from, you know, I don't own a farm. I don't own all that equipment. I don't have that huge investment. But I know that my members who are going to sit out there and listen to this show are going to be steaming over the fact that, you know, we can make light of this huge investment. You know, this is somewhat, these farmers, this is their way of life. This is what
they
believe in.
No, I know a lot of farmers that are
you know, I mean,
you know, same views as I have. I mean, you know,
it's
we're
a very serious thing for them.
No, it is. And nobody's making light of that. I think that it was just making, that it has a sense of humor that you have to laugh sometimes. But coming back to the heart of some of these things that in this farm bill, we're talking about these tens of billions of dollars going out. We talked earlier about subsidies, and some have argued, and let's talk about this a moment, and how this fits or should not fit into the bill, where it should be. There was a bill that was put forth by Shelley Pingree and Sherrod Brown, a congresswoman from Maine and a a senator from Ohio, respectively, called the Local Farms, Food, and Jobs Act. And part of that, though, inside the Farm Bill, is that they've cut the money for things like promoting local food, the community food projects, the $20 million for hunger-free communities programs. That includes SNAP, which is being cut back deeply, which is the food stamp program. As some people argue it should be, but it's being cut back deeply in this bill because it's also in this bill. And $4 million cut from the organic research funding that was $60 million, and Beginning Farmers Program, which is what you talked about earlier, Valerie, was cut back to half, to $10 million. So all these things are, you know, in the average age of a farmer's what in America is now around 57 years old. So there are people argue that if you change some of the way these things work, you could cut money from the deficit and maybe fund more of these programs. And how would that work? How does that argument work for you all in this discussion? And Valerie, you can go ahead, then go to David, and then Ted.
Well, again, you know, I think I've said it earlier. We think that the direction that the Senate took in drafting this year's Farm Bill is a step in the right direction. It does reduce the size of the Farm Bill and acknowledgement of the deficit, but, you know, tries to hold many of the programs in place, or at least provide some risk management for farmers. You know, we think that the young farmer programs are important. There's so many important programs out there, but in the budget times we're in, you know, we have to make some hard decisions, and we're just trying to make sure that there is funding for across the board assistance, so that everybody can be part of it. And, you know, I don't know that we're in a position at this point, Farm Bureau or Maryland Farm Bureau hasn't been in a position to look at each program or each project that has previously been funded and say yes or no to it. We've kind of looked at the general concept of where we're going with the Farm Bill at this point.
David?
Well, I strongly support every single program you just listed. And if the Farm Bill, again, is not passed, my understanding is that some of those will go by the wayside, at least temporarily, and once they're gone, it might be hard to get them back. So if there were no Farm Bill, I assume that those types of programs would have to be inserted into other agencies. I'm not sure which ones, and I don't understand the federal bureaucracy well enough to even predict. But I think that we have a bill. It's going to be voted on. It's an election year, so that makes things even more complicated than ever, but I would hate to see a bill get passed without those programs, and I would like to see much more money go into programs like those, particularly things like, well, feeding poor people, but also hooking poor people up with fresh, local, independently produced food. I live in Brooklyn, and yet, you know, our farmers market is packed. My food co-op, you can't even get into, and those aren't all, you know, rich, snotty people. It's a whole range of people, and I do see a lot of working-class people in Brooklyn taking a deep interest now in their food, working in community gardens, joining community-supported agriculture programs, and joining food co-ops, where in exchange for some labor every month, you get really good prices on really good local food. So those kinds of programs and things that the USDA is trying to do in connecting consumers to local producers, that to me is money very well spent.
Ted.
All right. So I am all about helping farmers. I love farmers. I love, you know, all my friends that are farmers. They're all great people. I'm sure there's ones that I wouldn't, you know, like that much out there, but everybody that I know is great. I have tons of equipment that I finance. You know, I have bank loans, you know, monthly payments, and, you know, farming is a risky business. But and I really want to see people fed. I want everybody to have food. There's no reason why anybody should starve in this country. That being said, I think the best way to do all of those things is to not get in the middle of farmers and consumers when they're trying to figure out what each other wants. I think the most efficient and effective way to do that is just to have the two parties with no middleman in the middle. There's no skewing the market, no market manipulation. Let's just have the producers and the consumers get together and figure it out. And that is the way I do things, and that's the way a lot of my neighboring farmers do things, and it works very well, and we don't need subsidies. So if it works for us, it can work for other people. You know, let's try to find a more creative way than just asking the government to do everything for us.
And as we're wrapping up here, I just get a closing thought very quickly, Valerie Connolly and David Kirby, on your thoughts of where you think this bill should go and where it should be at the moment. And then Valerie, then David.
Well, I hope the Senate votes on it very soon. You know, they came back from their week in recess, and hopefully they'll get to work on it soon. It'll get some time on the House or the Senate floor. Hopefully the House will take it up soon, too. The current farm bill expires at the end of September, and we think it's critically important to pass a new farm bill prior to that happening. We certainly don't want to do an extension and go into next year because most folks don't think the budget picture is going to be any better, and the pie that we're carving up right now is going to get even smaller if we have to wait till next year to figure this out. So we think in the best interest of everybody, we need to figure it out this summer, get it passed in the fall, and put it into effect as soon as possible.
David Kirby.
I would like to see much greater restrictions on income eligibility. There have been bills introduced this year and last year to lower the eligibility rate and to make people consolidate all of their income, all their farm income, into one figure so they can determine eligibility. That hasn't happened, and I get a kick out of some of these Tea Party Republicans who talk about all the wasteful government spending, but then consistently vote no on reducing these caps and allowing multimillionaire farmers to receive taxpayer money. That outrages me, and I think Ted's point is really well taken, that he's a farmer paying taxes, some of which is going to his next-door neighbor who collects, his hypothetical next-door neighbor who collects subsidies. So income caps should definitely be in place, and it, to whatever extent possible, to reduce the amount going to corn and soybean and grains and particularly animal feed, to try to level the playing field for small animal producers and to help direct some of that money. Again, if we're going to spend it, let's spend it on fruit and vegetable producers rather than big grain and dairy producers.
And Ted, you want to put a period on this? I mean literally a period for you.
The best thing we can do for farmers is to declare food sovereignty. We need to get rid of the ridiculous regulations that keep people from exercising their entrepreneurial spirit in agriculture and getting into the marketplace and helping to feed their local communities. There are so many ridiculous laws, and people need to understand that, and that is the main barrier to local farming success.
So I want to thank you all, and we will come back and do this again, seeing how long this bill takes to wind its way through Congress and figure out what to do with it next in terms of our conversations. And we'll really focus on Maryland, the Eastern Shore, and the rest of the state, and how this bill affects the state, and what we think should or should not be done on this bill. And we'll invite some of our guests back, of course. Valerie Connolly, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, Director of Government Relations for the Maryland Farm Bureau. Thank you so much for taking your time with us today.
Great, thank you.
And David Kirby, author of Animal Factory, always great to have you on the air, and we look forward to having you back as well.
Thanks, Mark. And if people listen carefully, there was a lot of agreement on this.
A lot of very interesting conversations, yeah. I thought so, too. And Ted Wykall, who runs the Green Branch Organic Farm outside of Salisbury, Maryland, joined us from Delmarva Public Radio, our home studio there with Chris Frank on the boards. And Ted, thank you so much as well.
Thank you. Nice to be with y'all.
And you've been listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm Mark Steiner. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.